My Aunt Mary is my mother's older sister. She's one of four siblings and is an extremely kind, generous, smart, and altogether beautiful individual that has touched so many people in her life, playing the role of a daughter, sister, wife, mother, aunt, and friend. She is a very intelligent woman who worked as an accountant and then got her master's in finance. But after having three children, she decided to switch careers from working in finance to working in the school district by helping kids with special needs. But her career and the many other roles that she played in her life were suddenly cut short in her mid to late 40s. We first started noticing Aunt Mary's memory issues when she was in her early 40s. At the time, they weren't significant enough to make us think that something was actually wrong, but eventually it reached a point where no one could deny that what we were witnessing was not just a typical example of someone that was just getting older. For the next several years, my aunt and uncle were in and out of doctor's offices, receiving countless tests in an attempt to figure out what was actually wrong. But every test kept coming back negative, and it never seemed like we were getting any closer to an explanation for why a woman we loved was changing so much. After years of searching for an answer through the process of elimination, doctors finally diagnosed her with early onset Alzheimer's disease at the young age of 51.
I'm your host, physical therapist, Jimmy McKay. That was Elizabeth Kerrigan talking about her Aunt Mary. We want to take a look at how physical therapy and Alzheimer's disease currently interact. We start with someone who's very familiar with patients with Alzheimer's disease and is often the first point of contact with patients and their families. Dr. Pasquale Fonzetti from Burke Rehabilitation Hospital in White Plains, New York. Dr. Fonzetti heads their highly regarded METS program, which stands for Memory Evaluation and Treatment Services. We wanted to hear firsthand what patients are told upon diagnosis and what treatments they're prescribed. What's a conversation with a patient and their family like when you deliver a diagnosis like that?
We able to arrange what we call a family conference. We call in the patient and the caregivers, the spouse, or the daughter or the son, with all the family members that are involved in the care with the patient. We provide an education about the disease progress, what they can expect by the treatment. And that's why we initiate the usually pharmacological and or non-pharmacological intervention. We provide education about how can patients be remain active with implementation of social recreational activity, provide education about what could be an appropriate diet for these patients. They need to maintain a good level of physical and social activities to maintain cognitive level.
When you bring those up, the physical activity, are there any specifications on that? Do you use any patient literature or brochure on exactly what that means? Because I think a lot of people who have a non-medical background or non-exercise background might not know how to take that and actually implement that.
Yes, that's important for them to maintain a level of activity that is appropriate for the level of function. I encourage daily walking. Unfortunately, some patients may have some gait dysfunction. I'm glad that you brought that up because here comes the multidisciplinary approach. Patients with gait dysfunction or gait apraxia, they are at risk of falls. So patients need to be instructed and educated how we can prevent those falls. And some of them may need gait training. Physical therapist provided very precious input about gait training.
Are your patients referred directly to physical therapy as soon as the diagnosis is made?
No. Patients with Alzheimer's disease in the very early stages and not their gait function are not affected. But as we progress with the disease, these patients may have a gait dysfunction. And that's when I refer to a physical therapist.
Correct. We've seen some research which showed that intensive physical activity prescribed by a physical therapist can actually help to slow cognitive decline. We know that staying active is good, especially for patients' dementia. What we've seen is the intensity is important. So is there anything that you guide your patients with Alzheimer's in terms of how intense to make that activity?
Well, it has to be intensive that it's appropriate for the patient's ability, of course. And I know that there are several studies that show a correlation between physical activity and cognitive function.
The main advice she was given by her doctors at the time was develop a day-to-day routine that she would constantly follow to help maintain some consistency and order in her life. It was suggested that she remain active and do things like word searches to help stimulate her brain, but that was the extent of it. For a while, my aunt would wake up and eat breakfast with my uncle and cousins, who helped her get ready for the day before they all went to work, which is when she would start her daily routine, which consisted of walking on the treadmill for up to an hour in order to follow the doctor's orders and remain active, as well as doing daily puzzles and word searches. But after a year, my cousins and uncle realized she would no longer be able to maintain this daily routine on her own. Within a year, her condition had continued to progress to the point where she was no longer able to be alone at any time.
What we heard from Dr. Fonzetti was the same that Liz's Aunt Mary heard from her doctors. Start pharmacological treatment immediately, remain active, both physically and mentally, and generally take care of yourself. But our question is that all we can do? Is that all that science knows about what we can do to slow cognitive decline in these patients? To find out, we talked with Julie Reese, a professor in the physical therapy department at Marymount University. Julie is a PT educator, clinician, as well as having conducted her own study on patients with Alzheimer's disease.
The study happened in 2012-2013, so I was lucky enough to land a small grant from the RDRAF Foundation, so it was from the Virginia Commonwealth University Center on Aging. So I was looking at balance interventions with individuals with Alzheimer's disease, and so I thought, well, we can use the BERG and the TUG and gait speed and assess those things and do intensive balance intervention and reassess and see if we're able to make some changes in balance. Because these people with dementia, they fall more than their age match peers.
So what'd you do?
Teamed up with three adult day centers in the area, and they helped me to recruit some awesome participants. And we set up a protocol of a three-month program, twice-a-week interventions. So we did this in groups, but because of the grant, I was able to hire a physical therapist to run the sessions, and I was kind of the assistant physical therapist at all the sessions, and then a group of student researchers. So we really had good oversight of all the participants of the program. And so if anybody was ever trying something new that was kind of risky for the first time, we were able to do one-on-one supervision while somebody else had two or three people that they were watching. So I really think it was the intensity, the fact that we were really challenging each person maximally, and we were trying to keep everybody up on their feet the whole time, that was kind of the magical piece of this,
right?
Not the specific protocol that we followed. I hired a couple of other physical therapists to do the pre and post testing so that I didn't want to bias it, because I knew I wanted them to get better. Mm-hmm. And so we had a couple of therapists did all the pre-testing. So they ran a BERG test, a TUG test, gait speed tests on everybody. And then we went through the three-month intervention. And then we did post-testing of the same tests. Again, the individuals who ran the post-testing hadn't seen the participants exercising. So while I may be thinking in the background, oh, I know this patient can do it. I know they can do that. I know that I've seen them do it better. That bias was not inflicted upon the post-testing. And then after the program ended 3 months later, we did a second post-test to see if there were any immediate benefit. Did it sustain over a period of time? The bottom line is, can we keep these individuals out of a residential care facility longer? Because we know that once somebody takes a fall and breaks a hip, that's like the beginning of the downward spiral that can be the end. And so if we can keep them up on their feet and safer longer, maybe they can stay home longer, maybe they can be more functional longer. So I'm proud to report that it did, from a statistical standpoint, it did impact balance. And so we were able to see that the BERG, which was our primary outcome, there was a statistical improvement in balance performance. And even though their gains decreased after the program was withdrawn at the end of 6 months, so they had 3 months of the exercise intervention and then 3 months without the intervention, at the end of 6 months, they still were better at balance than they were when they started.
While they were doing your program, they were better.
Mm-hmm.
And then even when they stopped, 3 months later, they weren't as good as when they were doing it,
right,
but they were better than when they started, which was 6 months before that.
Right. Right. And here's the crux of the whole thing was, I don't think it matters so much exactly what we did. I don't want to bottle our intervention because I think it's magical. But I think the characteristics of our intervention were magical. And those were things like maximizing intensity for each individual participant through each and every session, challenging each individual during each and every session, trying to keep everybody up on their feet as much as possible during each and every session. I'm constantly telling students or therapists that I'm speaking with, don't offer up those rest breaks. If you offer up a rest break, somebody's going to take it. If you physiologically see that somebody needs a rest break, sure, go ahead. But how often do we say, okay, Mrs. Smith, we just walked 7 feet from the bed to the chair. You want to sit down? She's definitely going to say, yeah,
sure,
let
not?
Me sit down. So that was one of the real important features of training the therapists and the students that I worked with, that we're on a mission here to really challenge these individuals and keep them on their feet. And we don't offer up rest breaks. I think that's one of the things in geriatrics in general that's just missing, is that intensity and that level of challenge. You know, you talk about a family trying to do what they're told, keep them active. Well, what's, you put them on a treadmill and they can't stop until you stop the treadmill. That's pretty great. But if they're moseying along, then it's unlikely to really push them forward or push them in the right direction. And it is, it's absolutely better than nothing, but maybe we could be doing more.
So there's some science right there.
Yep.
You mentioned one of the big words, which is intensity.
Yeah.
Liz mentioned that her aunt was told to stay active. And I want to bring that up because I think that's a point where physical therapy fits in perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're poised for that. So why aren't we?
Oh, I wish I knew. Somehow we're missing the boat on this. We think about, as a profession, we don't do the best job of marketing ourselves. Who should we be marketing ourselves to? Is it families? Yes, I think so. Is it physicians? Yep, I think so. I mean, we have to really get in on the ground floor of the people that have some push with these individuals with dementia or Alzheimer's disease. It's all the primary care physicians. It's all the physicians who work in geriatrics. They don't know of the benefits of physical therapy. And I think shame on us for not spreading the word about that. It's our burden to show what we can do. We're bad at tooting our own horns. We don't do that well, and it's served us poorly. It's a great question. I wish I had a great answer. You know, where to start now? But I think it is a matter of framing what we can do in a really clear and reasonable way. And the science is there. I mean, we don't know all the particulars about it. And we have the evidence that shows certain types of exercise has neuroplastic effects, not only on the healthy brain, but on the pathological brain with dementia. And we don't want to sit around and wait for any more science to tell us what we need to use to PR ourselves. But we do have to figure out how to present ourselves. We can present ourselves to each other because we know what we do, but we don't do a really good job of presenting ourselves to the outside world, to the general community, to the medical community. Some of us who are passionate about this and kind of, it's just even something like what you're doing here is a great way to start to get the conversation rolling and spread the word about what we're able to do. But how do we reach everybody else who doesn't know to learn more about it?
Right.
It's a mean disease, and to watch it really take away who you are is a really difficult thing for for families to watch. You know, one of the other things that I think it's, I'm thinking back to Liz's family getting that keep active push, which is actually good for the that medical team that told them
yes.
keep that woman active, because that's, it is, it's so important, but it just was a little too vague. So one of the things that I think about is, you know, this term of excess disability. Our individuals, the individuals that we see who have Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, over time, they appear much more disabled than they should, given their strength, their range of motion, you know, and this excess disability is really probably because we don't let individuals do what they're capable of doing. And it's strictly pragmatics too, right? I mean, you think about somebody with dementia needs to get from the house to the car. And if you're on a schedule, you're going to take their arm and lead them and open the door for them and help them in and buckle them up and shut the door. And so that becomes very rote, and that becomes what families do. And so over time, that person loses the ability or never has to practice the ability of doing that very simple thing. And it could be something like carrying their dishes from the table to the dishwasher. It doesn't have to be a big event. It is such a worthwhile activity to allow people who have cognitive deficit to do what they can do, maximize their level of independence. But what if 3 times a week, rather than hurrying the patient to the car and doing every component of it for them, you say, you know what, I'm not in a big hurry today. This time, I'm not going to hold their arm. I'm going to let them walk across the lawn. I'm going to let them experience that. I'm going to let them figure out how to open the car door, even though it not, may not be immediate, or they might need some guidance. They might need me to mold their hand around the door handle. But I think that we do our patients and our families do our patients a disservice when they are trying just to be loving and efficient and avoid frustration.
We learned from Liz's story that this disease never affects one person.
No.
It doesn't.
Right.
That education, that
right.
is another position that physical therapists are really, really great at.
Right. And then the other thing is, you know, these patients are a little bit different, and we have to recognize what they need differently, and that's how we're going to be really successful with them and see the changes. If we take a patient and we treat them exactly as we would treat their age-matched peer who does not have cognitive impairment, we're not going to be successful. And I think maybe physical therapists who don't know a lot about dementia, who come in contact with these patients and they have a couple of interactions where they're not successful, then they get the wrong idea. And they think, well, these patients can't benefit from this. Those are the couple of the things I try to really leave a therapist with. The idea that we started with, the intensity and level of challenge, the importance of that relationship, that interpersonal relationship between the therapist and the client or the patient, and then having an idea of what motor learning capabilities these patients have, how they're a little bit different than individuals who are cognitively intact. It doesn't mean they don't have the capability to learn. They do, but it's our burden to set it up so that they're set up for success.
I remember one more you taught in class.
What's that?
Smile.
Smile. I did say that. There's Dottie's 10 Tips for Interactions. It's on the Alzheimer's Reading Room webpage. So powerful. I share it with every talk I give. I share it. And Dottie is or was an individual with Alzheimer's who shared 10 tips for successful interaction. And at the end of at least 6 of them, she identifies the power and the importance of a smile.
Yeah, just smile.
Yeah. Yeah. How hard is that?
It might not help. It's definitely not going to hurt, right?
Aunt Mary is now 59 years old, and over the past 8 years, the disease has continued to progress to the point where she can no longer speak, walk, or care for herself. 3 years ago, our family was faced with the difficult decision of putting her in a nursing home because we were no longer able to provide for her with the amount of care she required day to day. She's been moved to the most advanced floor in the facility and requires help with absolutely everything. Dressing, bathing, eating, getting into and out of bed, moving from one place to another, taking her medications. If someone didn't go into her room in the morning and physically help her out of bed, she would remain in bed for the entire day. Luckily for them, my aunt remains in one place until she is physically moved to another, so they don't have to worry about chasing after her like they do with most of the other residents that are just as confused and mobile. But at the same time, this has resulted with her sitting constantly. All day, every day, and as a result, her muscles have completely deteriorated and she has developed contractures.
Now, we realize that Julie's study is small, but it gives us great hope for what exercise can provide for this population. But what if we could go larger? So we talked with Eric Vedoni from the University of Kansas Medical Center. Eric's got a great combination of being a physical therapist as well as a PhD researcher. He's currently the assistant director of the Alzheimer's Disease Center at the University of Kansas, overseeing the many projects they have that are focused specifically on Alzheimer's disease. I guess my big question is, you know, why we brought you in, where are we in the research with Alzheimer's disease in terms of something a physical therapist can do, which is exercise? Where does it stand? What does the research tell us that exercise does?
PTs are instrumental to the disease. And one of the things that we kind of misconceptions that we combat is that it's just a disease of memory, which is absolutely not the case. So we see over the course of time, people with Alzheimer's change the way they walk, the way they even just get out of a chair. Those are obvious, easy, low-lying fruit for PTs. But we actually see that the disease probably changes the whole system, the whole body. So people with Alzheimer's lose muscle faster. They kind of waste away. They lose bone. Actually, men with Alzheimer's lose a lot of bone, and they end up looking osteoporotic for much like older women. And so the base thing that we can do as PTs is just address that physical decline through exercise. I think that we're too cautious. How easy it is to dismiss an elder and say, oh, they're just going to have a walker. And I think that happens even worse and more so with people with dementia. We got to still recognize that the body and the brain are going to respond to challenge. So if you challenge that body and that brain with through the various ways that PTs know how to challenge, then there's going to be some response. And we have to understand that that's measured and it's going to be different for every patient and different for different populations, but we can challenge people.
Since you mentioned brain and you do a lot of brain imaging there at the University of Kansas, what does the brain imaging say that exercise does in this population? What does it do at a neural level? What do we know?
A couple of the things that we know, it changes brain size. We think that's probably associated with a little bit of neurogenesis, certainly supporting structures, increased vasculature of the brain. That's one thing. We also see that the brain seems to work better together in terms of communication between the different regions of the brain. The key that we think, especially here at KU, one of the things that we really think is important is that you have to move the needle on fitness or strength or whatever it is your intervention's targeting. You have to move the needle.
What do you mean move the needle? Is that in terms of intensity?
Yeah. So as a PT, we'd want to modify or to create this exercise plan for an individual that's appropriate for them that increases their VO2 max, for example, and actually a measurable increase in their aerobic fitness.
This just screams a location where physical therapists are poised to help out. If we're saying that there's a potential for exercise at an intensity to help prevent or at least delay, would I be correct in saying delay the onset of symptoms?
100%. There is no better profession in my mind to be providing guidance for exercise that we think helps, just as you said, delay onset of symptoms. It's only PTs who really have the full breadth of understanding of each individual and any comorbidities they may or may not have, how to maximally boost fitness or strength. It's really PTs who should be doing this.
So here's the million-dollar question. Why aren't we doing it?
Oh man, that's a hard question. I think sometimes PTs focus on what we can do with our hands, and maybe we don't value enough truly exercise prescription and how valuable we are in that. And if we start thinking of ourselves as individuals who can really provide great exercise prescription, considering all the different facets of an individual and how unique we are in that position, maybe we'll start to value that in ourselves. But that seems to me to be the answer. If we start valuing exercise and our ability to prescribe exercise, that will go a long way to starting that conversation.
How many different systems of the body in a patient with Alzheimer's or dementia do you think exercise could positively affect?
Every system that it affects in individuals without dementia. But there was a great meta-analysis about a decade ago that showed a meaningful change in cardiovascular fitness, musculoskeletal strength, flexibility, maintaining weight instead of atrophying, you know, maintaining function, supporting cognition, improving sleep, and helping maintain and moderate some of the behavioral changes of anxiety and depression. All of those things benefit from exercise in the general population, and probably even more so when you look at a clinical population like AD.
So Since being given this diagnosis, we were not given much advice on how to be more proactive or what to do next, and that the rest of her life was just waiting for the inevitable. She was told to exercise daily in order to help with her cognition, but it was never regulated by any trained professional, and she was expected to just maintain this daily routine on her own. Looking back now, I wish she had been in front of a physical therapist, somebody who's trained and is capable of regulating these types of routines. Remaining active is great, and that's something that she did every day for at least an hour by walking on the treadmill in her house, but there was no monitoring the amount of intensity that she was doing. And it's the lack of intensity is where we fall short.
There is more that can be done for the patients and families who live with Alzheimer's disease on a daily basis. What can the profession of physical therapy contribute? Well, if you've been inspired by Aunt Mary's story, you can learn more about what you can do, and then go do it. Find more information at moveforwardpt.com, search Alzheimer's. There you can find examples for signs and symptoms, diagnosis and treatment examples, as well as links to the most current research. The producers of this episode would suggest taking an APTA-accredited continuing education course on the treatment of patients with Alzheimer's disease. And always keep in mind, don't offer up those rest breaks. Resources and classes specifically for physical therapists and physical therapist assistants are available through the Alzheimer's Association at alz.org. Finally, if you're so moved to make a monetary donation, we would love for you to do it online to the Alzheimer's Association at alz.org in honor of Aunt Mary. Our most sincere thanks to everyone who's been a part of creating this episode: Julie Reese from Marymount University, Eric Vidoni from the University of Kansas, Dr. Pasquale Fonzetti from Burke Rehabilitation Hospital, Sky Donovan from Marymount University, Jason Bellamy from the American Physical Therapy Association, and finally, a thank you to Elizabeth Kerrigan, her Aunt Mary, and their family for allowing us to tell their story. Want to thank our sponsors, Arias Medical Staff, and you can find out more information about how you can get a job anywhere in the U.S. doing the thing you want to do, which is this physical therapy thing, with Arias. AURES medical.com. And one common misconception that I want to get out of the way right away: it doesn't cost you anything. Yeah, they're not trying to get money out of you and then find you a job. They're just sitting there with a bunch of jobs, and you're sitting there wanting to go to different places and travel around and be a PT. Match made in heaven. Arias is the leader. They'll get it done for you. AURES medical.com. Paid travel and housing benefits, positions in all of the 50 states, a variety of different settings, plus Con Ed money too. That's a big question in travel physical therapy. Great way to see the country, and you can do it as a new grad, a seasoned professional. AURES medical.com. That's Arias. These guys have supported the show from the beginning, so we want to make sure you support them. And by the way, they're going to support you by getting you a job doing some PT.